mathematical logic, I think it really doesn't. I think probably the ordinary language logic we're using would make it a little easier to understand, but it really shouldn't make much of a difference if you, whether you're using scholastic or mathematical logic. They would come out equivalent when you're studying Mises' epistemology. That's an interesting question. All right, well, let's get started. Some people have asked about the quizzes. As you probably noticed, my quizzes aren't very difficult, but I will say on exams, I'm reminded of a story I once heard from Bob Nozick. He said when he was a student at Princeton, he was taking a course in philosophy of science for Hillary Putnam, and Hillary Putnam had as one of the questions on the final exam, write your own question and answer it. So Nozick's response to that, well, it said write your own question and answer it. So his question was write your own question and answer it. And the answer is write your own question and answer it. Now, today we're going to get into sort of, in a sense, we start the payoff chapter, because we're actually going to get on to the process of reasoning that's used in this system of logic. Now, remember what we've been doing so far, we distinguished different acts of the mind. We start off with conception. That's where you get an idea or a concept about anything. When you get an idea, say I have an idea of an apple or idea of anything, I'm not asserting anything about it. I just have the concept of whatever it is. I have an idea. Then the second act of the mind is judgment. Here I say something that can be either true or false. I'm asserting something. And remember, I mentioned a number of times, it's extremely important to get this if we're to understand the way this scholastic logic works. Scholastic logic is the two main theory of the proposition. So what you would have in every proposition would have this a name in the subject place, and then what you'd be saying about the name, the predicate, I mean, when you're saying about the subject, the predicate is also considered a name. The verb is always is, and then you have your predicate, which is saying something about the subject. So you have, say, something, all men are mortal. Yeah, mortal is saying something about the subject, because that's considered a name. So then you have in a proposition, you have, again, the subject, and then you're saying something about it. It's another, so you have the two names, subject and predicate. They're connected by is, which is called the copula, the link between subject and predicate. Now, we now get on, what we're starting today is we have the third act of the mind, which is inference. And what we're doing in inference is we have, say, when we have two propositions, two of these connections of subject and predicate, we're able to come up with a new truth. We start off with two, and then we're two propositions, we're able to come up with another true proposition. And in addition to connecting in a judgment, we can also deny that there is a connection. Like, both I say, no angel is mortal. That's denying any connection of angels with mortal beings. It's separating the two rather than connecting. But when I said connecting, you should take it to include both separating them. We usually talk about positive propositions more frequently, but you can have negative ones also. Remember, there, in addition to these A and I propositions, the positive ones, there are also E and O, which are the negative. So when we have this process of deduction, where we're coming up with a new truth, we're moving from a general truth to a particular, more general truth to a more particular truth. Like, take the trite example people always give, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. We've moved from the general truth, all men are mortal, to a particular truth, Socrates is mortal. So in deduction, it's always this movement from general to particular. Now, just set, Michael had two questions. Is the first one, did Nozick get that question right? Well, I think he actually decided not to use that as his real answer. He just put it down, but then actually thought of something else. And now, can judgment connectors separate more than two concepts? Well, not in this system of logic, but you could have pretty complex terms in one of the, in the subject and predicate place. You know, they don't have to be just one word. So, as I say, deduction moves from the general to the particular. Now, we also have a reverse process to that, where you start off with particulars and move to more, to more general statements. This is called induction. We'll be talking about it in the last lecture, if I live so long. But we should just note right from the start, an induction is not something that gives you something that's guaranteed to be true. It's only deduction that guarantees the truth of what you come up with. Now, in a deductive inference in this, we're studying in this system's logic, it's called a syllogism. This is a term that Aristotle used. And every syllogism has three propositions. There are the two premises and the conclusion. So if we deduce, if we carry out the deduction correctly, the premises make the conclusion true. If the premises are true, then the conclusion is also true. This has to be the case. Once given the truth of the premises, then the conclusion is also true. Now, it's, you have to be very careful here when you say, sometimes people will say the premises make the conclusion necessary. So you have to be very careful how you take this. What's necessary is this whole process where you have given these premises, the conclusion follows. It can't be the case that the premises are true and the conclusion is false. But it doesn't follow from that that the conclusion itself is necessary in the sense that the conclusion couldn't be otherwise. That's to say, it's only a conditional necessity to say, if these premises are true, then the conclusion is true. But you can't drop the premises and say, well, now you've shown the conclusion is necessarily true. Now, I give an example of this. Now, let's take this as a syllogism. It said, all Keynesians are opponents of the free market. And the next premise is, Krugman is a Keynesian. So we get, therefore, Krugman is an opponent of the free market. Now, as we'll see shortly, that's a valid syllogism. If these premises are true, they make it the case that Krugman, it's true that Krugman is an opponent of the free market. But the conclusion is not necessary in the sense that it couldn't be otherwise. He could change his mind. I mean, suppose he has a debate with Bob Murphy comes through, and then he realized Austrian economics correct. He changes his mind. So then it wouldn't be true that he's an opponent of the free market anymore. So you see the conclusion doesn't have to be true. It's just that given the premises, then the conclusion is true. If the conclusion came to be false, that's right, one of the premises would have to be changed. Now, someone asked a good question here. Did I Yes, that's right. You anticipated the point I was making. Good people are up on things. Okay. Now, I've said in syllogism, we come up with a new truth. And I've given some examples of syllogism, but how do we actually do this? How does this take, this whole process take place? And the answer is, we, by using a middle term. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, remember, every syllogism has three propositions in it, the two premises and the conclusion. And each proposition has two terms. So that would be maximum possible. You have six possible terms. But in fact, every syllogism has just three terms, not six. So you can see there's going to be repetition there. There's going to be repetition. You know, you won't have separate terms in, you won't have completely separate terms in each premise. You'll have repetition. And what you will have is, you'll take, you have a conclusion, which will have a subject and predicate. And the premises will join respectively. You'll have the subject term joined with one premise, which is called the minor premise. And the predicate will be joined, the predicate will be joined with the middle term in the other premise, which is called the major premise. So the, you have in the premises, this middle term is connected to the subject and another premise to the predicate of the conclusion. And then in the conclusion, its middle term drops out. So you have that, so you take the middle term is kind of a tie that enables you, that links the subject and the predicate of the new, of the conclusion. So it drops out. Now, you want to get how exactly does this process of connection work? I give an example here. I have the example is, we start with the major premise, all giraffes are married. Then the minor premise is, all men are giraffes. So we conclude, all men are married. Now, you can see, you want to know what is the middle term in this syllogism? Well, it's the one that doesn't occur in the conclusion. So here, the middle term is giraffes. And the key principle that I'm using this to help to explain is, I'm using this example to explain, is how this process of tie, how it, the middle term ties the, enables you to tie the subject and predicate and conclusion together. It's through class inclusion. Now, I could have, if I knew how to draw circles, I could have shown this in circles, but drawing circles is a bit too hard for me, so I didn't do that. But basically, what we have is the middle term is included in the class of the predicate. So here, the middle term is giraffes, and it's included in the class of married entities. So we're saying we have, imagine a class of all the possible things that are married. And we're saying giraffes are included in that. Then we have a second act of class inclusion. And here what it is, we're saying men are included in the class of giraffes. So we get from there that if men are included in the class of giraffes, and giraffes are included in the class of married entities, then we get that men are included in the class of married entities. So the basic principle here is one that if something is in a class, and that class is in an even larger class, then the first class, the smaller class, is in the larger class as well. So this is a basic principle, class inclusion. this Aristotle thought this is really the basis of syllogistic reasoning, the principle of class inclusion. Now, one point Joyce makes is, he says, this is a rather difficult point, but I'll mention anyway. If you don't get it right away, don't worry about it, but it's just, it's important, but it's a bit of a sideline. Joyce makes a big deal of saying, when we're talking about class inclusion, we're talking about, now Mike asks, are we learning to be class conscious? Well, only if we're studying proletarian logic. But Joyce makes a big deal of saying that we're talking about the meaning of the concepts when we talk about class inclusion, not the extension of the concept. And by that, he means that it isn't that we say we're counting up all the men and then counting up all the giraffes and seeing that the men are all included in the giraffes, in this case, or seeing that all the giraffes are included in the class of married entities. We're just talking about the meaning of giraffes and married entities and men. Now, can anybody tell me or say, why does he think that's important? Why should we emphasize that? Why does he want to emphasize that we're talking about the meaning of the concepts? We're not talking about the extension of class. We're not saying, well, let's just count up which entities are included in which class. We want to talk about the meaning of the concept. Does anybody want to try that? It's a very difficult. I thought it was a difficult question. I was kind of saying universal versus particular. Well, I mean, you would have though both. But yes, I think people are getting in the right area. You see, the thing is, if we were to talk about the extension of the class, then we wouldn't really be able to come up with something new, because if we were just counting the entities, we would already know the conclusion is true, you know, just from counting up the entities. We'd say all men are married because we'd see that men are part of the class of giraffes, and giraffes are in the class of married people. If we just counted them up, we'd already know what the answer is before. We could only know the premise is true by counting up the entities in the first place, so we wouldn't be getting anything true, anything new, I should say. So it's only if we take it in this conceptual way that we can come up with new truths. This is an objection. John Stuart Mill raised this as an objection to syllogism. He would say, we can't know this major premise, all giraffes are married, unless we've already all we could do is count up the number of men and count up the number of giraffes and so on. So we wouldn't be getting anything new. But if we reason conceptually, we can. So this is why he says it. But yes, that's right. Michael says it would be a fact, not a result of reasoning. Yes, but I mean, don't worry if you don't fully grasp that. It's just a side point. I think it is an important one to mention. All right, now this is basically, I just went over, this is just going over what I said before. I guess I should have gone on to the slide, but I'll just go over again. Why does the connection enable us to arrive at a new truth? It's because the subject is included in the class of the middle term. The middle term is included in the class of the predicate. So in this example, as I mentioned, giraffes are in the class, entities that are married, men are included in the class of giraffes. Thus, men, the subject term and conclusion, is included in the class, entities that are married, the predicate of the conclusion. Now here in this this next one, there's a bit of a difference. You know, I mentioned so far class inclusion. Now remember though, syllogisms don't have to have all positive premises. You know, they don't have to be all A or I proposition. Remember, an A proposition is one like all men are mortal. An I proposition is some men are mortal. We can also have E and O proposition. Remember, an E proposition is something like no men are mortal. And then a universal negative. And an O proposition is a particular negative, like some men are not mortal. So, like I said, if we have in the syllogism one of the premises is negative, let's say an E or an O proposition, then we're going to have the explanation of how we get new truth is going to be a bit different. Once I see one question, if a conclusion is false, what can we say about the premise? If a conclusion is false, we validly deduced it, then one of the premises would be false also. But now let's get back to this example. Everybody's required to laugh to pass the course. I say, no hippopotamus is a goalie. Some men are hippopotamuses, therefore some men are not goalies. Now, this is a valid syllogism. Someone put a funny face here. Find out what the middle term is. Remember, you say, which is the one that isn't in the conclusion? It's hippopotamus. So the major premise, the one that connects the middle term with the predicate here in the conclusion is goalies. So the major premise is no hippopotamus is a goalie. So what that premise is doing, it's excluding hippopotamuses from the class of goalies. It's saying you can imagine a circle with all the hippopotamuses in it. It'd have to be a big circle because hippopotamuses are big. And then you have another circle with goalies, so there's no hippopotamuses in that class of goalies. Now the minor premise, the one that's connecting the subject term men with the middle term, is some men are hippopotamuses. Now, of course, this is a false premise, but that doesn't affect the validity of the reasoning. So what we're saying here is that some men are included in the class of hippopotamuses. So we can conclude from that those men, the some men who are hippopotamuses, are not goalies because no hippopotamus is a goalie. So you see, we have in the negative syllogism, we still have class inclusion for one premise, but we have in the other premises the class exclusion. So you see the difference there. Now I think the next slide, there's a couple words omitted, but hope this doesn't confuse. And I said, it should be, the conclusion says that some men, namely the ones who are hippopotamuses, are excluded from the class of goalies. You see the way that worked. Just to go over it again, I'm saying the first premise said no hippopotamus is a goalie, so that's saying you have here are all the hippopotamuses, the goalies are over there, and there's no overlapping. Then you know some men are in this, you imagine, in the circle with the goalies, so those men can't be, some men are in the circle with hippopotamuses, so those men, the ones who are hippopotamuses, can't be goalies because the whole class of hippopotamuses are excluded from the class of goalies. And that this syllogism, I guess, leaves open whether the men who are not hippos, if there are any, whether those men are goalies. Just saying the ones that are hippos are not goalies because no hippopotamuses are goalies. Okay. Now, Joyce gives a number of different rules for the syllogism. I'm not going to go through all of these, but I just want to mention some of the more important ones. Now, one, you remember in the last lecture, I mentioned a piece of terminology that I said would be very useful, and here is where it comes in, the notion of a distributed term. Now, a distributed term is one that we know how much of the extension of the term is covered. We know how much of the class is covered. I suppose I say all men are mortal. Well, I know that the term here, men, is distributed because I'm talking about all men. I suppose I said no men are mortal. It's distributed because I know I'm talking about men in the class. But if I say some men are mortal, it's not distributed because I don't know how many men are mortal, what part of the class of men is mortal. So, you mustn't look at Wikipedia then. You won't need to come to my lectures and that would ruin everything. All right, now, let's say all men are mortal. Well, we don't know immortal. There is not distributed. We don't know how much of mortals are men take in. So distributed, remember, means that we know how much of the class is covered by the term. So in our example I gave, giraffes is distributed in the major premise because I said all giraffes are married. So that means we talk about all giraffes, so then giraffes is distributed. It wasn't distributed in the minor premise. When we say some men are giraffes, we don't know how much of the class of giraffes is covered by some men. It could be that some men are all the giraffes that there are. There could be giraffes left over after we're taking count of some men who were giraffes. We don't know. So here the term giraffes is undistributed. I should say also, suppose we have something like, let's take the famous Socrates is mortal. Is Socrates distributed? What would you say about that? Well, we have a yes and no, so someone's right. No, well, it is distributed because we take it that distributed in one of the premises. It doesn't have to be distributed in both, but it can be, but it has to be distributed in one of the premises. And if you violate that rule, then you get the very famous fallacy, called the fallacy of the undistributed middle. Probably you've heard of this. And I give an example of this. We start off with the premise, all men are married. Then we have the premise, some married people are divorced. So we get, and then we have the purported conclusion, all men are divorced. Now, here we ask again, what's the middle term? Well, what term doesn't appear in the conclusion? It's married. So married is the middle term. So you say, well, is married distributed? Well, is it distributed in the major premise? The first, we say all men are married. No, because we don't know, it's not just talking about married entities, we don't know how much of that is covered by the men who are married. We just say all men are married, but we don't know how many of these married entities are men. And then the minor premise, some married people are divorced, it's again not distributed. So we don't know, again, how many of the divorced people, how many of the married people are divorced. Could be all of them, it could be not very many. We don't know. So the middle term isn't distributed, and then so as a result, the syllogism isn't valid. So you must have a distributed major term in one premise. Now, somebody's finding it something confusing here. It's just to go over, if you want, apparently there was some sound off. If you have a singular term like Socrates is more, that's taken as distributed. It's a distributed term because it's the whole class of Socrates is taken that way. Now, another rule is if a term is distributed in the conclusion, it has to be distributed in the, it must be distributed in one of the premises. I give the example here, all mortals are crazy, some men are mortals, therefore all men are crazy. Now here, what's the middle term? Well, we again would say, which is the one that isn't mentioned in the conclusion? It's mortals. So is it distributed? Yes, it is, because the major premise is all mortals, so that's distributed. But the syllogism is still invalid because we have in the subject of the conclusion, it says all men are crazy. And here, men, all men is a distributed term. We know the whole class, we're talking about the whole class of men, all men. So men has to be distributed in one of the premises. Well, the only premise that mentions it is some men are mortal, and it isn't distributed there. So that's not a valid syllogism. Remember I said before, in a syllogism, we're moving from the general to a particular. Like we're saying all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Now someone asked, was the answer, is Socrates mortal, distributed or not? Yeah, it is distributed. Now Matt asked, is the order of the premises important? That I'll be covering a bit later in the lecture. It's really, a syllogism would be valid however you state why the premises come in one order or the other, but there are customary ways of ordering them that I'll be dealing with that a bit at the end. So, as I say, if you didn't have a general premise, that's say an A, which is a universal affirmative, or an O, universal negative, you wouldn't be moving from the general to the particular. So you wouldn't have a syllogistic reasoning. And I give an example. Some men are crazy. Some crazy people are Keynesian. Therefore, some men are Keynesians. Here, you don't have any, you don't have an A or an O proposition. These are all, what are these propositions? Anybody, how are they in the A, E, I, and O? Yes, that's right, they're all I propositions. And here, that's right, everybody passed it. So here also, this purported syllogism would commit the fallacy of the undistributed middle, because the middle term is crazy. And in the first, the major premise is some men are crazy. Well, it's not, crazy isn't distributed there. We don't know how many of the crazy entities are covered by the some men. And in the minor premise, we talk about some crazy people are Keynesian. We don't know how many of the crazy people are Keynesian. So it's undistributed. So that's definitely not a valid syllogism. Now, another rule here is, this is a very interesting one, a syllogism cannot have two negative premises. That's to say, you can't have a syllogism that contains just E or O propositions in any combination. And I give the example here, no Misesians or Keynesians. That's an E proposition, saying Misesians are excluded from the class of Keynesians. Then the next premise is no Keynesians are Marxists. That's to say, all the Keynesians are excluded from class of Marxists. So you got the conclusion, no Misesians are Marxists. Now, as it happens, this conclusion is, of course, true. No Misesians are Marxists, but it doesn't follow from the premises. Because, again, we say, what is the middle term? It's Keynesian. So the first premise is just separating all the Misesians from the Keynesians. And the next premise is separating the Keynesians from the Marxists. But it leaves entirely open what the relationship is between the Misesians and Marxists. It could be the case, of course, it's false in reality. It could be that Misesians are a subgroup of Marxists, or it could be that Misesians overlap Marxists. That would be entirely consistent with the two premises, that no Misesians are Keynesians and no Keynesians are Marxists. Now, one thing I'll mention here, it could also come in later, is sometimes you'll hear people say you can't prove a negative. Now, this is not a different point from this principle that says a syllogism can't have two negative premises. What that claim would be, if you say you can't prove a negative, would presumably be you can't have a conclusion be a negative proposition, and you can't have a conclusion E or O proposition. That's false. I mean, as we'll see a bit later, there are valid syllogisms with negative conclusion. You know, incidentally, if someone said you can't prove a negative, well, that would be kind of a strange thing to say. Yes, Michael said exactly what I was going to say. It's itself a negative, so you couldn't prove it. That's an excellent point, Michael. You must have stolen the lecture notes I don't have. Okay. Now, remember I said a syllogism has to have three terms. You have the subject, the conclusion, the predicate, the conclusion, then a middle term, and you have each premise will be a combination of the middle term. You'll have the major premise, the middle term, plus the predicate of the conclusion. Minor premise is the middle term plus the subject of the conclusion. So you have three terms. So suppose you had a term with two meanings, then you'd really be having four terms in the syllogism, and it wouldn't be valid. So I give an example of this. You say all heavy objects are objects that weigh at least 10 pounds. Now, just to see if people are following, why did I phrase this in kind of a clumsy way? All heavy objects or objects that weigh at least 10 pounds. Why didn't I just say all heavy objects weigh at least 10 pounds? Yes, that's right. You need an is, so you have to rephrase your proposition. So you always have this is form, so you get these two names. So you have all heavy objects or objects that weigh at least 10 pounds. Then the next premise is human action is a heavy book. So we conclude human action is an object that weighs, should be at least 10 pounds, I guess more than 10 pounds is really going beyond what the major premise allows. So here, heavy is used equivocally because in the first premise, it just means having a big weight. But in the minor premise, I've said human action is a heavy book. We mean heavy in the sense it deals with difficult subject matter. So here, we're using the term in two different ways, and it isn't a valid syllogism. Now, one thing, as you no doubt realize from reading Joyce, he tends to go into very elaborate details on things. Now, Eric asked a very good question. Does the rule against equivocal terms rule out the validity of arguments using analogous term? Well, I wouldn't say no. You just have to be very careful the way you use it in a syllogism with analogous terms. Your conclusion would also be analogous. It wouldn't necessarily involve four terms, but you'd have to be very careful on that. It's an excellent question. Now, as I say, Joyce goes into very elaborate detail. One thing that was very much concerned scholastic logicians was what they called figure and mood. Now, remember, I've said a number of times that in a syllogism, you'll have the major premise will have the predicate of the subject term, I mean, the predicate of the conclusion and the middle term. And the minor premise will have the subject of the conclusion and the middle term. So that will be in every syllogism. But there's an additional question, which is called figure, which means what is the order of the predicate and subject in the major and minor premises. Now, for example, in the first figure, there are four figures. In the first figure, the middle term is the middle term has to be distributed in one of the premises. It doesn't have to be distributed in both, but it can be, but it has to be. Hello, I'm back now. I think I'm back. Okay, can you hear me now? Good. Okay, so here we say, what is the middle term? Well, it's mortals because mortal is the one that doesn't appear in the subject. So here, mortal is in the subject position in the major premise. All mortals are men. And it's in the predicate position in the minor premise. All crazy beings are mortal. So this is called a syllogism in the first figure. Go figure that. Now, mood refers to the type of propositions in the syllogism. You have the quantity and quality. You have A, E, I, or O. Remember, A is universal, affirmative, all men are mortal. I is particular, affirmative, some men are mortal. E is universal, negative, no men are mortal. O is particular, negative, some men are not mortal. So mood is, tells you, you just take your propositions, the three propositions, you have the two premises and the conclusion, you say, what is each proposition? You just have your list, like you have in the example I gave, just gave, you have A. It, the one I gave is a valid mood, A, and it's in the first figure. And Aristotle thought that was the most evident form of the syllogism. He thought if you had an AAA syllogism in the first figure, that's really the one that really shows how syllogistic reasoning works most clearly. Really see this how this class inclusion takes place. Now, Brian asks, is it always the minor subject plus the major predicate? No, I mean there are four valid figures. I mean, there are four valid figures, and you get, there are 19 valid moods. There are valid moods in each figure. There are 19 of these. Now, I don't think it's important to go, I'm not going to go through what all the different valid moods are. This one with the AA, in the Middle Ages, they placed a great deal of stress on getting all these valid moods. And one thing they also emphasized was that if you have a mood that isn't in the first figure, that's it. Remember, the first figure is one where you have the major premise has the middle term as a subject. Is a subject, and the minor premise, the middle term, is the predicate. They thought if you don't have a syllogism in the first figure, there are rules by which you can reduce that, so you can change the propositions you have in various ways, so you'll get a syllogism in the first figure. And they had they made up Latin words so you can remember all the valid moods. Like say in the first figure, the valid moods would be AII, and EIO. Those would be the valid moods in the first figure. So they would have these mnemonic that you can remember them. I'm not going to go into that. Just one historical point is a bit interesting, I think, is that one of these names is Barocco. That's in Barocco. It tells you it's A-O-O. So some people, one of the theories, you remember, from your art history or general history, you have Baroque art in this form, very elaborate ornamental art, began in the late 16th century and lasted the early 18th century. Some people think that the name Baroque comes from this funny Latin word for one of these syllogism. Now, one thing, when I mentioned this, Barocco, it has a conclusion, it's a valid mood, A-O-O. This is an example where you have a negative conclusion. So you don't have to, it's not a rule of the syllogism at all, that the conclusion has to be an A or an I. You can have a negative conclusion, it just has to be one of these valid moods. All right, now, someone has a question about there was possibly a mistake on slide 13. Let me just check that. Let's go to slide 13. Okay. Is this, a syllogism must have one general proposition, an A or an E. Yes, that's very good. I'm glad you caught that. It should be an A or an E. Very definite. Thank you very much. Whoever saw that, I'm sorry. I'm not a good proofreader of my own stuff. So you're quite right. It should be an E proposition, not an O proposition. Oh my. Thank you. And see, I couldn't pass my own course. Okay, now, when we go on to the fallacies, I want to spend some time on what I think is a very interesting case. It illustrates fallacy of equivocation. Now, this is an example that's fooled a lot of people. A lot of very good philosophers, including Karl Popper, have used this argument, and it isn't right. Now, I want to see what you people think of this. Popper pointed out, it's from a book by Tom Palmer, the idea that one could predict one's future knowledge is philosophically incoherent. If one could predict one's future knowledge, then one would already know it. How many of you have heard this argument before you read it on my slides? Are people familiar with this? Oh, good. Now, could I ask, did people think this, who saw this, think it was a good argument? Well, there is slides be corrected, but possibly. No, you don't get. I mean, you don't get an F. No, I can. Yes. Well, what the argument seems to be making a very substantive conclusion. It seems to be saying there are some people who say we could predict our future knowledge, but we can't do it. There's kind of a limit on what we can predict. We can't predict anything. We can't predict our future knowledge, and there's some sort of, there's a logical argument that shows that. And so this would be a very significant conclusion. Now, Palmer in the book wants to use this for a good purpose. He says, well, the socialist planners think they can predict what the economy is going to be like in future according to their plans, but they won't be able to do this because you can't predict future knowledge. Simply on the grounds, if you did predict it, it wouldn't be future knowledge, it would be knowledge that we already know. So what's wrong with this? The argument here is relying on ambiguity in what's meant by future knowledge. It could mean either knowledge we don't have now, but will have in future, or else it could also mean, though, knowledge we have now, but will continue to have in the future. For example, suppose I say I now know that 2 + 2 = 4. Well, presumably, I'm going to know that in the future, too. So if you can predict what you know in the future, then what you predict won't be future knowledge in the first sense. You can see why that's true, because if you can predict it, it means you know it now, so it's not going to be the case that it'll be knowledge we don't have now, but will have in the future. The first sense is just saying future knowledge is knowledge we don't have now, but will have in the future. So anything we can predict won't be future knowledge in that sense. But it can still be future knowledge in the second sense, namely knowledge we have now but will continue to have in the future. So the sum and substance of this is, all this argument is showing is that if you predict something, it isn't something you didn't predict. It isn't imposing any limits at all on prediction, it could be the case, for all this argument has shown, that I know now everything I'm going to know in the future. So what's very deceptive about this argument is it makes it seem that you have this very neat logical argument that shows some kind of limit on what we can know. We can't know what we'll only know in the future. We can't know what we'll know in the future. But in fact, it doesn't impose any limits at all on what we can know. It's just saying that it's just defining future knowledge so that anything we know now doesn't count as future knowledge, but it leaves perfectly open that we know everything we will come to know later. Let me just give you an example. Suppose, as unfortunately is false, that suppose I knew what the outcome of the Super Bowl is going to be. I absolutely knew that. I wish I did, because then I could make a lot of money on bets. But suppose I know that. Now, I know what the outcome of the Super Bowl is. So it's not the case, then, that that's future knowledge in sense one, because I won't have to wait till Sunday night to find out what the outcome of the Super Bowl is. I know it now. So, but that doesn't stop me from knowing what the outcome of the Super Bowl is. Of course, I don't in the real world, but there's not, this argument doesn't rule out that I know what the outcome is. It's just saying, if I do know it, then it's not the case it's going to be something I will know only in future. But it doesn't, it's really just a tautology. It doesn't say anything really significant at all. Okay. So a lot of people use that argument, but I mean, once you think about it a bit, you'll see it really doesn't establish anything. Okay, now the next one is just a very simple one, which I got from Norman Podoritz, who's a literary critic who is somehow a self-styled foreign policy expert. So what he says there is, he favors interventionist program in the Mideast. It would be very relevant now to some of the situation in Egypt and elsewhere. He says, well, thinks we should go in and establish democratic regimes in these countries. And he said, look, we shouldn't think this is utopian to think we can do that, because the countries there, the regimes there, have only been in power a comparatively short time. It isn't they're very well-established regimes that would have to be uprooted. So it isn't utopian to think we could just get rid of them and replace them with something better. So the fallacy here is just a simple non sequitur. He says it doesn't follow from the fact that these states came into existence less than 100 years ago out of the ruins of the defeated Ottoman Empire in World War I, that there's nothing utopian about replacing them. It's not evident what is supposed to be the connection with the premise and the conclusion. Just as, well, they didn't exist for a long time, so it's not utopian to think we could replace them with something better. It's uncertain. How is it supposed to follow? It isn't clear at all. Now, the last one I'll give, it's a more theoretically interesting one. Now, this one is an argument that's very often used against libertarian anarchism. Remember here, we're not concerned with the merits or otherwise of libertarian anarchism. I'm just interested in the structure of the argument. So the argument often given against anarchism is something like this. Well, in libertarian anarchism, you have competing protection agencies, and these agencies might come into conflict. You can imagine protection agencies coming into conflict. So you'd have to have, if they could come into conflict, you have to have some other agency to settle it. But supposing people didn't accept that settlement or the appeals agencies got into conflict, wouldn't you have to have some central agency that would be the ultimate agency to settle all disputes. So what is wrong with this argument? Well, this commits what's a fallacy we haven't discussed previously. It's called the quantifier shift fallacy. This is actually a term used more in mathematical logic, but you know, we can easily adapt it to the scholastic logic. Here we're moving from every dispute requires some agency to settle it, to there's some agency that must settle all disputes, and this doesn't follow. We can see why. See, we said the first one says for every dispute there must exist some agency to settle it. The conclusion is there's some agency that must settle all disputes. But of course, we can sometimes if we're puzzled about an argument, we can just construct a parallel argument where we can see what the problem is more easily. What do we say? Start off with everyone has a father. So this is similar structure to every dispute requires some agency to settle it. Everyone has a father. So we can see this doesn't imply there's someone, that someone is everyone's father. It would be pretty busy. So you see here it's a similar point. The fact that if it's a fact every dispute requires some agency to settle it, doesn't follow that it has to be the same agency that must settle all disputes. So you don't have to have you don't have to have an ultimate appeals court. And it could be just if you have, for each dispute, you could just have separate agencies to resolve that one. Well, okay, so I think that concludes the lecture. So for the rest of the time, we'll just have questions, objections, anything. I hope I don't get knocked off the lecture like last week. Andreas said, will you be discussing St. Anselm's argument for existence of God? That would be epic. Well, that's a very difficult inference. Now, I mean, that's a very difficult argument. Eric says immediate inference. Well, you know, maybe I'll see if I could say a little bit about that the next time if I can fit it in. Michael says, would you say there must be a supreme arbitrator in each category of dispute? Well, I mean, that's a substantive question about political theory. This, you wouldn't be able to establish that if you thought there would be by this argument. You'd have the same fallacy. Now, Danny says, did the scholastics go much beyond Aristotle's logic? Yeah, to some extent they did. The medieval logic was extremely well developed, and they were especially good at dealing with logical paradoxes. I mean, if you look at people like John Buridan, were extremely subtle logicians. There's been a great deal of work on medieval logic, and it was developed by the later scholastics even further. So it's a very, there definitely was developments since Aristotle. Now, Sean says, I have a question regarding the argument you cannot prove God does not exist. This is usually where people say you cannot be called upon to prove a negative. I don't think that would be right. I mean, suppose somebody claimed, I don't think he would be, someone who claimed this would be right. I mean, supposing, as some people do, somebody thought there's some conceptual impossibility in the concept of God, then you would be able to prove that God doesn't exist if that argument would be right. So there'd be nothing in principle that say you can't prove a negative. Now Matt says, if you're omnipotent, all-knowing is a fallacy because you can't change what you're having for lunch tomorrow. That's a much discussed point. I don't think that's actually right because it it wouldn't be saying, no, you're going to have something for lunch tomorrow. It wouldn't be that you can't change it. It would just be, if you did change it, you would no longer believe that that was what you were going to have for lunch tomorrow. So I tend to doubt that. Now, Carl says, be interested to address Mike's idea, all non sequiturs are two premises lacking a middle term. Let me see. Well, could you come up with a case? I think you could have a case where you had a middle term that wasn't distributed. You know, you'd have there and the conclusion wouldn't fall, but that you'd have the middle term wouldn't be distributed. Now, I think he said something about the middle terms have to be properly concatenated. So maybe he's covering that. I'd have to think about it. It's plausible that there's something that he may well be right, but I'd have to think about that further. Yes, I think Eric is right on that theological point. Determinism and knowing the future are two very different things. That's right. Is a red herring and a straw man the same thing? No, I don't think so. I think a red herring is, these are all just colloquial, so red herring would be something where you introduce some irrelevant issue into the argument. Like you say, oh, well, we don't have to take this person's argument seriously because this person was convicted of was a convicted murderer, so we don't have to take his argument seriously. Now, a straw man would just be more of a caricature of somebody's argument. Like you say, well, libertarians believe in chaos. They don't think there should be any laws at all. They just believe that people could just settle things without any rules at all. So that would be a straw man, because that would be not the same thing. Now, Eric says, futures, are you referring to logical consequences, cause effect, or one event following another? I think it would just be one event coming after the other. I mean, to say that something's happening in the future wouldn't commit you to a theory of saying that the present events logically imply the next event. Brian said, did you miss my question? Could you repeat? Let me just see if I could find it here. Brian, term, is this the one you say, terms are equivocal because the sense they're used in is not defined? Can a context be created for an argument that eliminates the equivocal term? Well, in some cases, in some cases you could, but you might not be able to. If you define the context, it might make clear that you've used the term in two different senses. So it would just, if you define the sense, you pin down whether you have a fallacy there. But I think presumably if you have an equivocal term, you would be able to specify what you meant by it. So then you would be able to tell whether you were using it in a proper way or not. Was Scholastic, Danny says, was Scholastic logic important for the development of proto-Austrian economics? Well, I think it was. You know, it was the Scholastics, like Salamanca school, were sort of experts in Scholastic philosophy, including logic. And again, Menger was very much influenced by Aristotelian logic, and you know, you have connections, say, between Franz Brentano, who was the great Scholastic, late philosophy has been much influenced by Scholastics and Menger and others. Barry Smith's book on Austrian philosophy goes into that very much. Now, Eric asks, how much does definition play in the validity of arguments? Well, sometimes people, definition is important, but you shouldn't think that every term has to have a strict definition, because you know, then you get into an infinite. It'd be difficult, but we know what tables are. So I think definitions are important, but not all important. Now, let me see. We define things by their nature. Aren't we then reasoning from the definition? Yes, that reasoning from the nature thing, that's very important. That's what we do in the syllogism. We talk about the concepts of the thing, the meaning of the thing. That's very true. Now, let's see. E.T. says, somehow you can use statistics to predict future human actions because human actions are governed by time-invariant causes. Can you use a syllogism to prove that we can't know future human actions? Well, I think if you take the view of Mises and human actions are not governed by time-invariant causes. You know, we're free to choose a course of action. You know, whether you could prove that is a matter maybe we'll talk about in my next course. But so I'd say the notion that human actions are governed by time-invariant causes, I don't think involves a straight contradiction unless you define a human action in a way that would exclude its being caused. So it would just be a matter of exploring the various philosophical arguments on the point. There wouldn't be an immediate logical fallacy. Now, can you use a syllogism to prove we can't know future human action? We want to know what would be the premises of such a syllogism. I mean, I'd like to see people come up with one. I wouldn't commit myself to saying it couldn't be done, but I haven't seen it done, but there are all sorts of future actions. Human actions we do know, like I know what I'm going to have for breakfast tomorrow. So I don't think there's anything. I think sometimes people tend to think, oh, well, we can't know anything about the future. That was one reason I covered that fallacy. Now, Andreas says, I thought Mises was determined. Well, he actually was, in the sense that he thought that there were probably ultimate physical laws that explained everything, including human behavior, but he thought we don't know we can't figure out what these laws are, so in explaining action, we have to rely on freedom of choice. I mean, that whether he was right about that is, of course, another matter. Eric says knowledge requires certainty. No one is certain about the future, therefore no one can know the future. Well, I mean, supposing I said that I don't see why one should hold that no one, if knowledge requires certainty to the extent it does, I don't see why one would have to hold that one couldn't be certain about the future. Why would you think that? I mean, supposing you're thinking something like this. Well, if something is in the future, then possibly it's not going to happen. It's not logically required that it happen, so no one can be certain about it. But there, that's confusing logical necessity with certainty. I mean, suppose I say, I'm certain that I now exist. Well, it's not logically necessary that I exist. I may be certainly a possible state of affairs that I don't, but it doesn't follow that I can't be certain about it. So even if it's logically possible that some event in the future not take place, it doesn't follow that I can't be certain that it will. At least it's not clear to me. Now let's see, we have another one. Well, this is interesting. Now, Anish suggests that classic logic seems to be much more applicable to complex verbal arguments than mathematical formalism. Well, anyone wants to know why did scholastic logic fall out of academic favor? Well, I think it was logicians thought that scholastic logic couldn't handle certain types of statements, such as relational statements. I mean, it's arguable that it can, but many logicians thought it couldn't, and many logicians were interested in developing very intricate formal systems. So that what they would say is that scholastic logic is just sort of one small branch of modern logic, and also they think there are things that are wrong with it. Let's see. Yes, that's right. Joyce does discover. Yes, that's an interesting suggestion. Maybe we couldn't know what how the laws would be acted on. That's an interesting suggestion. Yes, now Mike says scholastic logic is often unidirectional. Well, it's often, let me say, when you have a causal statement, it's often unidirectional. It doesn't have to be. Would Mises be classified as a compatibilist? Would he thus agree with Schopenhauer that man can do what he wills but cannot will what he wills? Yes, I think Mises would be classified as a compatibilist. Compatibilist is someone who believes that determinism is true, but that doesn't stop people from having free will. Now, it's interesting, you quote Schopenhauer here, say, man can do what he wills, but he cannot will what he wills, because Hayek used to say, quote that exactly. So that was Hayek's view of the matter also. Now, there is a contrasting view, which is called incompatibilism. This is a view that determines inconsistent with free will, and people who are incompatibilists, they often believe in what's called strong free will. Strong free will is the position that even if all the laws of nature were exactly the same, we could imagine someone choosing differently. So imagine, say, all laws of nature leading up to some choice someone chooses, we can imagine sort of replaying the scene and the person could choose in a different way. Now, Giuseppe says, do Austrians generally use scholastic logic? Well, I think generally they use ordinary here again. Am I back? I think I'm back now. Good. Okay, good. I don't know why they sometimes does that. So Giuseppe said, what was the question? What I would say is Austrians don't usually explicitly specify a logical system that they're using, but it's certainly what they do is compatible with scholastic logic. Okay, I thought I'd get more of an argument on the attack on the Karl Popper argument. Now, let's see, Andreas said, every soldier has a premise, and their premise is that back those up. We just reach a point where we need to stop at the validity. And I said, could you comment? Well, I think it is true that we have to, excuse me, just had a twist of my leg here a bit. We have to come up with, we have to come up with some premises that we aren't able to support by further argument. You know, we have, say, here is, we have a major, minor premise, and we say, well, support our conclusion, and we say, well, what is the support for that premise? Then we could come up with another argument in favor of that premise. And we'd ultimately get back to some argument, some premise that wasn't supported by further argument. But remember, it doesn't, remember what we said about the quantifier shift fallacy, you know, in this last slide. It doesn't have to be that there's a single premise that's ultimately justifying all arguments. Just for any chain of arguments, there has to be at least one premise that isn't supported by a further argument. We wouldn't have an infinite chain of premises. It doesn't have to be the same premise each time. Okay. Oh, somebody's not able to get on to the meeting. Okay, now does anyone want to try to defend Popper's argument? Danny says, would Mises say that traditional conception of personal God is logically impossible because it posits both perfection and action, which presupposes it felt uneasy, which is imperfect. Yes, he does say that. Now, actually, I think his argument isn't correct there. It's a very interesting point. See, what Mises says is in action, we're, someplace says, well, in action, we're starting from a point that we're dissatisfied, and then we're trying to improve that. You know, going to a more highly valued state. Well, God is supposed to be perfect, you know, so he wouldn't be able to act because everything's all right. There'd be no need for any changes. You see, the problem there is, it isn't, as Mises recognized elsewhere in human action, it isn't actually the case that we're in action, we're trying to change where we are now. What we're actually faced with a choice of what we're going to do versus what would happen if we didn't act. So what we're comparing it really in action is what our action is versus what would happen if we didn't act. And that's compatible with a being that's always satisfied. It's just that he's acting in order so that he doesn't become dissatisfied. And that would be compatible with someone acting. So it's sort of really, I think Mises is wrongly relied on an ambiguity in the statement of what the conditions for action are. It isn't that you're dissatisfied now, it's you're really dissatisfied with what would happen if you didn't act. Now, Ned asked, does originary interest prove that usury as meaning rate of interest can't be eliminated? Well, I don't think it would prove that. It would just, I mean, you could have, say, laws forbidding people to take interest. It would just be the monetary, usury for the monetary expression of originary interest. It would just be then that what couldn't be eliminated, if Mises is right, is just this way of valuing future versus present actions. Now, Brian says Popper is an argument for fallibility, which naturally says the future is unknown or unknowable, including our understanding of natural law. Well, he would say this. In fact, he would also say, you know, he's a fallibilist about everything. So he tends to say that we really don't know much of anything. He's pretty much of a skeptic. So you're quite right. He would say that, but the point is, he exposes, he's right about that. I don't think he is, but his, that particular argument that I gave from him wouldn't show that we can't know the future. It just, it's just a tautology. See, it doesn't show. So even if he's right that we can't know the future, his argument wouldn't show that we can't know our future knowledge, you know, on the grounds that if we knew it, it would be present knowledge. That doesn't show anything, at least if I'm right. As Mises defines it, I think human action is pleonastic. Yes, I mean, he doesn't actually offer a definition. I think you're right that he doesn't have, he just offers a definition of action. You know, it would apply to any being that fulfills the conditions of that. You know, some similar, Kant says that ethics, morals, applies to all rational beings, so it's something like that. I mean, I don't think it isn't dependent on particular qualities of human beings, although of course he has human beings in mind as the subject. I'm not clear, they admit that some are, but not are, all are inapplicable. I'm not clear what that's supposed, and then something not all theists say. Eric says tradition concept posits the eternal present. That's right, I mean, I didn't get into that in discussing this argument from how, whether God could act, but I mean, that would certainly have to be brought in, you know, if we were going to analyze this this argument further. Andrea says, could I say in defense of Popper that I can't know how my actions will affect the future? Well, I mean, you could say that, but I mean, what would be the reason for saying that? I thought I'd handle it. Are there new ones I haven't gotten to? I'll have a look at the forum questions I hadn't seen. Maybe people sent them in after. See, I turned off my emails that notifies me about this so I can get on this website. So I'll look, maybe I have it. I'll go look and see if I've missed any. I think Popper is very much a philosopher worth reading. Has a lot of very provocative arguments, but I don't think he's right on this one, and I don't agree with his general approach to induction or knowledge in general. But I mean, he's certainly a very important philosopher. You have to read him. Now, he has a very good article, say, on Marxist dialectics. You know, he uses that point. Remember when I was talking in the lecture last time about contradiction explosion, where if you admit a violation of a law of non-contradiction system, you can deduce anything. So use that point to attack Marxist dialectics. It's a very interesting essay. I think you can get it in his book, Conjectures and Refutations. So, I mean, he's certainly one of those you have to read. He had a great influence on Hayek. Andrea said, could I just say I don't know how my action will affect future? Do I have to need an argument? Well, you could say if it seems evident to you that that's the case, you could say that, but I mean, it wouldn't be clear that you're right. I mean, suppose you said you know that in a few minutes you'll be leaving this lecture, this Academy session. I think you would know now how your action's going to affect the future in that respect. I'm not clear. You know, I think people tend to think, oh, there's some sort of general problem about the future, but it's not clear to me what the problem's supposed to be. Now, Popper said the utility monster would be someone who just gets more and more utility from consumption, no matter how much he consumes. But I think the problem there is Popper's taking utility in kind of a psychological sense, like thinking like how much satisfaction and sense of feelings you're getting met. But in law of utility, you have to take it as what is the unit of consumption the person is considering. So it wouldn't be something like, imagine a case where somebody just eats ice cream, and no matter how much ice cream he eats, he just keeps wanting more and more of it. Well, you just say there that the person would have a very unusual way of specifying what the unit was of ice cream consumption. You wouldn't take in kind of a psychological sense, I think, the way Popper's taking. Sometimes people use utility monster. Well, Nozick used utility monsters as an argument against utilitarianism, where it's a better... Oh, there it's a better... Nozick didn't use that to disprove law of diminishing marginal utility. He used that as an argument against utilitarianism. And suppose you say in utilitarianism that you want to maximize total satisfaction. So Nozick, well, what if somebody just gets enormously more satisfaction out of things than everybody else, which you have to give him all the resources. But Nozick didn't use that against the law of diminishing marginal utility. I was just imagining a way one might try to do that, but Nozick certainly didn't do that, at least not in the years I knew. Yes, that's why you can't compare utility intersubjective, because utility and necessity in terms is just preference rankings. Well, I guess we're about out of time. Does anybody have any final thoughts or questions or comments? Oh, thank you. What would be fine? No, I think as we're planning now, there'll just be a there'll be a quiz every week, including the last week, but who would win in a fight, Aquinas or Hume? Well, they were, you know, it'll be a very interesting fight because they're both, those two philosophers were the two heaviest of the great philosophers, so it'd be quite a wrestling match. Oh, Michael, thank you for your comment. Now, E.T.'s... future human action prediction, we would have to prove the statement future human actions are predictable is predictable, which is absurd. I'm not offhand seeing what the absurdity is supposed to be, but I'll think about that further. It seems like maybe you think it's absurd to think that human actions are predictable, but that's what's up for dispute. Okay, well, thanks very much. Thanks a lot. Hope you'll see you next week, and thank you. Thanks again. Bye, everybody. Okay, well, I'm going to press the stop recording button now. Thanks again. Okay.